That was Joss Coban singing You Raise Me Up. Wonderful song. You are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, and we're now having another episode, episode 30 of Health and the Awakening of the Self. This program concerns itself with the health of the individual, help to restore your health and preserve your health. We give out information for that purpose. And also the other part of the program is to realize your real self as distinct from who we think we are, but we're not. 2,500 years ago, Buddha discovered that the self or the personality or the persona is only an illusionary made-up self from mental thoughts and projections. And basically, it's a persona. It covers up something else. It covers up the real self. A persona means mask or something that covers up over something. It's not the reality itself. It just covers it up. So through the process of self-inquiry, are what's called the non-dualistic teachings. In the East, they're called Vedanta, and they go back thousands of years. So through the process of self-inquiry, we help to uncover the inner awareness of who we really are. My name is Dr. Mike. I'm a medical doctor, an MD, and a naturopath, and I've been a teacher of meditation for a good number of years. If you need to call, if you would like to call into this program at any time, and you can feel free to do that, you can interrupt whatever is going on. The number is 831-427-3772. That's 831-427-3772. And the email is frsc at freakradio, all one word, freakradio.org. And if you have a spiritual master you'd like to hear on this program, please get in touch with me and we'll see about putting him or her on. The slogan, as usual, of this program is, may the mind dissolve in the heart, or may the mind fall into the heart, may the mind dissolve in the beingness or the aware presence that we are. And just to remind you, you can't really realize the truth by either reading a book or listening to a radio show. But if you do the spiritual exercises that we give out here on this show, or if you do the what's called the guided meditation that we tend to give out towards the end of the show, that will help you further your consciousness into a wider space, a space of more freedom, a space of more peace, a space of more creativity, and a space of compassion. All the good qualities that life has to offer. All right, the first program we're going to do is by Master Spira, and it's entitled Allowing the Mind to Sink into the Heart, the same title as we have for the slogan of this program.
Awake in the morning is okay, my identity, my issues, problems, my agenda for the day, the identity is there.
Okay, this is my first evening back since I got sick. And, you know, you remember my voice was pretty bad in the early days. So the piece we're going to play actually is a slightly different piece. You are the Holy Spirit. So you are consciousness or the Holy Spirit. So here we go. It's Master Muji is speaking on this one.
I guess my question is this awareness. When I observe things in consciousness, the play of consciousness,
yes.
When I see consciousness from the seeing of awareness does that awareness have a taste?
Yeah.
Do I join the laughter, the dance, the laughter and the suffering of consciousness at that level of consciousness, or do I just observe it? Does this awareness have a taste to it? Do I laugh? If I see it from awareness, do I laugh with consciousness? Do I cry with consciousness?
Well, you know, maybe the laughing will happen in consciousness, the crying will happen in consciousness, but the one who is crying will not happen.
The one who is?
The one who apparently is thinking, I am crying, will I laugh? Will I cry? I is what? I must be the consciousness itself. You see?
So there's no laughing or crying in awareness, in seeing from awareness.
Yes, I said earlier, you see, because we are not talking about forms. If I'm saying how far away from these two they are, you say, well, edge to edge, maybe 4 or 5 inches, because you can measure this. They are two forms. But because awareness is formless, you speak of consciousness, it's formless. Mind, formless. I, formless. So it's, we are trying to speak accurately about something that has no boundary. You see?
But is there a taste in awareness?
No. But tastes appear in awareness. Awareness has no taste. You see, those who have come to this recognition, there's a silence in them. Someone asked just a few days ago, you know, but you, if you go into a battlefield and you see, you know, such carnage and so, you know, do you want to act and run about? You say, I don't know how it will be. But I will tell you something. I'll give you an example. Huh? You know, I don't know if any of you here have had what they call near-death experiences. Where you see also the sensation is you're out away from the body. And you may see all type of activities going around in a kind of excited space. But your own self is in an environment of total composure and peace. It's like if 1,000 angels descended upon the battlefield, they will not be running around going, did you see what happened? No, their presence will emanate tremendous love and tremendous compassion in a silence and a stillness about it. The presence of holiness, the presence of the Holy Spirit. You are this Holy Spirit. When you come to know who you are, then holiness is shining from you. Not panic, not exciting. Oh my God, look what, oh, it's terrible. No, this, not this. Something else. Even to have the presence of this presence itself is already changing the environment, washing it with love and grace. You see,
how can you retain this awareness?
Yes, this is the thing, you see. Come to complete understanding that there is no you to do it. This is what we're having trouble. Who is going to retain awareness? Even this very idea is an idea just arising like a cloud in the sky. How is the cloud going to help the sky to be more bright, to be more sky-like?
I understand.
Yes, you see?
Yeah.
Who is going to help? Who is going to reach and sustain and stay as awareness? No, there's only the awareness. Nobody's staying there. There are no addresses in awareness. Oh yeah, Jesus lives over there at number 29. Muhammad is living at number 32. Okay. There's only the infinite expanse. No one is resident there. You are that. There's no there for awareness. There and here exist as ideas in awareness itself. I cannot find another word in any language that comes more to give a little taste, a sense of it, than space. Space-like awareness, they say, like emptiness, free of quality, because qualities are not reliable. They are coming and going. That which is perceiving the coming and going of quality also is a tinge of this pure, formless awareness and mind that can perceive even the subtlest taste. And even the perception of that is arising in awareness itself. Who can speak? Awareness is not a dead space. It's not inert. It's neither alive nor dead. It's beyond all. No word exists anywhere that can convey this. Yet all these words, they appear through the mind and consciousness, appearing in the awareness itself. I am that awareness. I am that awareness. Undying, unchanging, unalterable, unsplittable, unaffected, timeless, eternal, unbound, pure, immaculate. It's what is. That's what is. This is what is. And what emanates out of it, all this magnificent universe, is known as its creation. Whatever names, there are so many names of God, but He's beyond name, the unborn principle. It's here also. It's here. It's here. Within which this meeting called satsang take place, this talking is taking place, listening is taking place, comprehending is taking place. The fruit of this is also taking place. The people next door on the treadmill is taking place. Same consciousness, you see. It's making all that, those little half-dead pizzas down the road is cooking and it's taking place. Everything is taking place in it. Here it wants to know itself. Here it wants to know itself. It wants to only stop associating. This is what satsang means. Because the nature of mind and consciousness is to associate with something. Satsang means to associate with the highest truth. Which means to associate with your own self.
He mentioned that the Master Muji mentioned at the beginning of that talk about out-of-body experience. Well, we do have somebody today who had an out-of-body experience and changed his whole perception of life and the cosmology of life. And he is Eben Alexander. He's a neurosurgeon of something like 20 years. And he had an out-of-body experience that changed his whole life. He's written a book called The Proof of Heaven, or Proof of Heaven. I'm not exactly sure if there's a D in there or not. But we're going to play some of his... I'm reading his book right now, about one-third of the way through. We're going to play an interview of his, and so we get an idea of what happened to him. He got meningitis and he went into a coma and he had all these experiences on other planes of life. And initially he was under the belief that the body and the nervous system supplied the consciousness, was responsible for consciousness and the mind. And since he had this experience, he completely changed his mind about that. And He now says consciousness is independent of the mind, and the mind is independent of the brain, and consciousness is independent of the physical body. All right, we'll get to that in a little while, but right now we're just going to play a little a little music, and this is Michael Crawford. He's singing "With Love." I think he's singing from I dreamed a dream from Les Miserables. That is the name of the opera, Les Miserables. All right. Let's see. I just have to get it queued up here.
And dreams were made and used and wasted. There was no ransom to be paid, no song unsung, no wine untasted. But the tigers come at night with their voices soft as thunder as they tear your hope apart, as they turn your dream to shame. By my side, she filled my days with endless wonder. She took my childhood in her stride, but she was gone when autumn came. Till I dream she'd come to me, that we would live the years together. But there are dreams that cannot be, and there are storms we cannot weather.
Okay, that was pretty short, but that was Michael Crawford singing a track from Les Miserables. And next we have Dr. Peter Glidden, and excuse me, and his last name is spelled G-L-I-D-D-E-N, and the name of the title of the talk is Why You Should Fire Your MD Now. He's got a point. he says that MDs are not trained in nutrition, and they really don't know any nutrition whatsoever. We put too much faith in MDs, and he's right about that, because naturopathic physicians, they have very extensive training, just like an MD, but they understand that the body has the inherent energy to heal itself. We just have to remove the obstacles and give it those things that the body can use to heal itself. So we'll hear what he has to say now. I mean, it sounds a little radical, but I think actually it's quite true what he says. So listen carefully.
You're taught about in school is MD-directed medicine. The only medicine that your insurance pays for is MD-directed medicine. The only medicine that's practiced in your hospitals is MD-directed medicine, and certainly the only medicine they make TV shows about is MD-directed medicine. But MD-directed medicine is just one small piece of the greater pie of medical science. And yet, because the MDs have monopolized the medical theater in this country for 100 years, we equate medicine with MD. And we don't know that there's another way. We don't know that there actually do exist science-based, clinically verified, safe and effective alternatives to MD treatments delivered by licensed physicians, and they're due. But we're not aware of this in the United States because of 100 years of pharmaceutical company propaganda. And here's how it breaks down. While the MDs have been driving the bus of medicine in the United States, the leading cause of death in the United States is MD-directed medicine. You can source this information at the front page of my website. There's an article called Death by Medicine. It is a 45-page long, extremely well-referenced document. It draws data from the New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of the American Medical Association, the Lancet, and a number of other very prestigious medical journals. The way that the numbers go, the leading cause of death, 780,000 people a year killed by MD-directed medical treatments. The second leading cause of death, heart disease. 699,000 people a year killed by heart disease. The third leading cause of death, cancer. 550,000 people a year die from cancer. And when I read an obituary and I see that somebody's died from cancer, when I read an obituary and I see that somebody's died from heart disease or from the complications of a simple medical procedure, you know what I think? I think medical failure. But most people give the MDs a pass when they fail because we don't know that there's another way. Because they have monopolized the medical industry, when their therapeutics fail us, when their therapeutics harm us, or even when their therapeutics kill us, we give them a pass. Because we don't know there's another way. You don't know what you don't know, and when it comes to health, the stuff that you don't know will kill you or will heal you. It's like the movie The Matrix. We are all deeply embedded in the matrix of the myth that the MD is the king of medicine and that the therapeutics delivered by the MD are the only valid medical therapeutics. This is why we let them continue to hurt us. This is why when their therapeutics fail us, we give them a pass. We have thrown $1 trillion of money into cancer research. Who have we given it to? The acupuncturists, the chiropractors, the naturopaths, the homeopaths, the Ayurvedic medical practitioners, the traditional Chinese medical practitioners? No. We have given it to the MDs exclusively, and they have failed us. After $1 trillion of research money, cancer rates have remained unchanged. After $25 billion of cholesterol-lowering statin drugs a year, the heart disease rates are unchanged. And yet, while we let the MDs direct our health care, arthritis increases, high blood pressure increases, fibromyalgia increases, Alzheimer's rises from obscurity to the sixth leading cause of death, and 1 out of 80 kids now are born autistic. And we give the MDs a pass. The reason that we have a healthcare crisis in the United States is because we go to the MDs with a chronic health condition. Your MD is completely incapable of helping you recover your health in the face of a chronic health condition. Facts are a stubborn thing. Look around. Everybody in this country is sick. Everybody in this country is suffering. Everybody in this country is beneath the wheel, laboring under the weight of a chronic health condition, taking prescription medicine after prescription medicine, surgery after surgery in order to fix the problem, but the medicines do not fix it. But we don't know there's another way. So we're in pain, we're sick, we're suffering, and we're being taken advantage of by a medical community, a medical monopoly, that goes out of its way to tell you the lie that everybody but them is a quack. Everybody but them is a back-of-the-bus, dangerous medical practitioner, even though their therapeutics consistently fail. Just look at the numbers, ladies and gentlemen. Heart disease, cancer, unchanged. Chronic health conditions getting worse and worse. Obesity getting worse and worse. Why? Well, if you listen to your MD, it's your fault. You're too lazy. You have a bad gene. You have the cancer gene. You have the obesity gene, and you do not. The reason that your health is in the crapper is because you have gone to the wrong doctor. You have taken the wrong dog to the hunt. You didn't even know there was another dog in the hunt. You didn't even know you had access to anything but MD-directed medicine, and the MDs like it that way. If you're happy with the current status quo of your health, then God bless you. But if you know in your heart of hearts that there must be a better way, here's the better way. Fire your MD. Fire your MD now and get educated about science-based, clinically verified, non-drug solutions that actually support and promote your body's ability to fix itself. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Dr. Peter Glidden. You don't know what you're missing.
Okay, I think I agree with him for the most part. MD medicine is good for when you're in an accident, you need to go to the emergency ward. But as regards chronic illnesses, most doctors don't have any idea how to fix those problems. They only rely on what the pharmaceutical industry hands out, which is drugs. And drugs have definitely very limited use and in terms of healing the whole body. So, that's probably a good thing. Now, we'll move on now to Michael Crawford in concert, Music of the Night. Music of the Night.
Nighttime sharpens, heightens each sensation. Darkness stirs and wakes imagination. Silently the senses abandon their defenses. Slowly, gently, night unfurls its splendor. Grasp it, sense it, tremulous and tender. Turn your face away from the garish light of day. Turn your thoughts away from cold and feeling light. And listen to the music of the night. Close your eyes and surrender to your darkest dreams. Purge your thoughts of the life in you before. Close your eyes, let your spirit start to soar. Secretly possess you. Open up your mind, let your fantasies unwind in this darkness which you know you cannot fight. The darkness of the music of the night. Let your mind start a journey a strange new world. Leave all thoughts of the world you knew before. Let your soul take you where you long to be. Only then can you believe.
falling, sweet intoxication. Touch me, trust me, savor each sensation. Let the dream begin, let your darkest side give in to the power of the music that I write. The power of the music of the
was Michael Crawford, the music of the night from the opera The Phantom of the Opera, written by Andrew Lloyd Webber. And when I lived in London, England, I went to see that opera, and Michael Crawford was the principal male singer in that opera. So a really nice song, a very nice singer. And we're going over now to Eckhart Tolle, and the name of his talk is Create Space in Your Relationships. If your relationship doesn't have any space, then it becomes very reactive and very emotional. And I call these relationships roller coaster relationships, because they're up one minute and down the other. However, if you have space in the relationship, so much more harmony, love, and good feelings come about, and so much more control emotionally. Anyway, we'll hear what Eckhart Tolle has to say. He'll explain it better than me.
Like, as the alert, aware field of presence. And that is the determining factor in any human relationship. Whether space consciousness is still present, whether there is space in the relationship, whether there is space in you in the relationship, or whether you are absorbed totally in object consciousness. And that's any kind of relationship. The question is, are you there as space? Is there a depth, a space from where you relate? It begins with the ability to listen to the other person. That is very closely related to being present, to listen in that alertness, no matter what words are coming out of the other person's mouth, and whether it's in business relationship, or whether it is in your personal relationship, or whether it's in a relationship that is very fleeting, very short encounters in an elevator, maybe just a few words are spoken, in a shop, in a restaurant with a waiter, And it all comes down to a moment of no thought. Just alert, spacious presence. With your partner, listening to him or her. Somebody who comes to you with in an agitated state, totally absorbed by some life situation. This has just happened, you can't... And the world will draw you in, want to draw you in to complete identification again with things. You remember we mentioned the word things, meaning not just physical things, but including physical things. Some people's attention is totally into physical things. Their belongings, their house, their car, their dog, their... That pull is very strong, and that's the challenge. The world wants to, and the world is ultimately the human mind, becomes externalized as the world out there, wants to draw you back into total identification with object consciousness, objects. This matters. This is so important. And I'm always amazed what kind of things people make important in their lives. How ultimately insignificant the things are that they make important, more important than their state of consciousness. They're more important than peace, more important. The tiniest things can assume an importance that you give the power away to things, you give them the power to make you unhappy. And what kind of things people give that power to is just amazing. Ephemeral, fleeting things and situations that are here one day, gone the next. Things that would pop even if you discovered you had a serious illness or you have an accident, which sometimes can be a great awakening, things that would pop like a soap bubble and their unimportance would be revealed. If somebody told you you have a serious illness and you had to be concerned with all that, suddenly it has no significance whatsoever. The heavy problems that you had been carrying around dissolved at once. This is why for some people a serious illness is the great awakening. Out of total immersion in object consciousness. There is no guarantee that the illness will awaken you because it could add a further heavy object to your mind, the concept of me being seriously ill, which would add a further heavy thought form to identify with to your mind. That is possible too. But potentially, an illness has the ability to awaken you and to reveal to you that which is at best relatively important. And the truth is, anything in this world of form, of things, is relatively important. And your career, your possessions, your relationships, what you have achieved or not achieved, what you know or you don't know, things that people derive their self, sense of self from, all relatively important. Yes, it's relatively important whether I live in the street, sleep on park benches, or I have a nice home. Yes, it makes a difference in the realm of relativity. But you can be awake on the park bench as you can be awake in a nice home. And some people awakened precisely there after losing things. Things to identify with. So only there's only one thing that matters absolutely in one's life. Then the rest of your life is recognized as relative. It's not that you ignore it, but you recognize that the importance is only relative. And the one thing that matters, and Jesus used those words too, there's only one thing that matters, he said to Martha in the story of Mary and Martha, two women or two sisters. He's visiting, and one is extremely busy. Let's get this done and that done. We have to get the meal ready. Look, he's here. He's visiting us. He's come and help me get the meal. This needs to be done. Peel the potatoes. Do this. And Mary wasn't doing anything. She was just sitting there looking at Jesus. And Martha says, why don't you tell her to help me? And Jesus wasn't really concerned whether when the food would be on the table or whether it would be on the table. He said, Mary, there's only one thing that really matters. This is a free translation. And Mary has chosen that one thing that really matters. Now, when you look at modern theologians, they can't tolerate that statement, and they do whatever they can to reinterpret that. He didn't really mean that. Another simple way of putting it is you forget that the only thing that really matters is your state of consciousness, nothing else. If that's not right, nothing out there is going to be right. And you're not going to be of much help to anybody. To see what is primary, that is not selfish, far beyond it. It's the opposite of selfish. To recognize that. And then, what is so important to have the power to make me unhappy?
Okay, that seems to be the end of that talk. So we'll move back again to some music. And our guest this evening is Michael Crawford in concert. So now he's not too far from here is the name of his next song. Not too far from here.
I found myself drifting back in time to when I was a 10-year-old choir boy. The one thing that made a lasting impression on me was the beautiful music that I heard and sang. Music that could inspire and comfort and touch us all. Some pieces we recorded were written hundreds of years ago, others only yesterday. But they all share a common bond, the ability to transcend boundaries and beliefs and connect directly to the heart. Somebody's down to their last dime. Somebody's running out of time. Not too far from here. Somebody's got nowhere else to go. Somebody needs a little hope. Not too far from here. Now I may not know their name, but I'm praying just the same that you'll use me, Lord, to wipe away a tear. 'Cause somebody's crying not too far from here. Somebody's troubled and confused. Somebody's got nothing left to lose. Not too far from here. Somebody's forgotten how to trust. And somebody's dying for love. Not too far from here. It may be a stranger's face, but I'm praying for your grace to move in me and take away the fear. 'Cause somebody's hurting not too far from here. Help me, Lord, not to turn away from pain. Help me not to rest while those around me weep. Give me your strength and compassion when somebody finds the road of life too steep. Somebody's troubled and confused. Somebody's got nothing left to lose. Not too far from here. Somebody's forgotten how to trust. And somebody's dying for love. Not too far from here. Now I'm letting down my guard, and I'm opening my heart. Help me speak your love to every needful ear. Someone is waiting not too far from here.
Again, that was Michael Crawford singing Not Too Far From Here. He's a great singer, no doubt about that. Okay, we're moving back now to the book I'm reading at the moment is called Proof of Heaven, and it's Dr. Eben Alexander, who's a neurosurgeon for 25 years or something, and he got this very, very virulent E. coli meningitis that started eating his brain away, and he had these experiences on the other side, on the other planes of existence. And he tells us about his experience. He's being interviewed here by I believe it's I've forgotten now exactly, but it's it'll come up in the conversation.
This is where we search for evidence of life after death and ask the meaningful questions around that subject. Wow, today, what an amazing time we're going to have. I'm excited for you. I'm excited for me. We have an author to a book which is written about his near-death experience that has just hit New York Times bestseller, number one on the New York Times bestseller list. It's such, people want to hear about this subject, they want to learn more about it, and this is proof of that. And speaking of proof, the title of it is Proof of Heaven. There you go. Well, I'll back it up a little bit. Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife. There's a picture of him. You guys can see him beside me. Welcome, Dr. Eben Alexander. We're so happy to have you here.
Well, thank you, Bob. It's great to be here.
Yeah, this is really exciting for me. It's exciting for a lot of people who are familiar with Afterlife TV and been watching Afterlife TV for about a year now. We only started about a year ago, and people have heard a lot about near-death experiences. Yours is really unusual. It's a very unusual near-death experience, as you found out after you finally started researching them, which was after you wrote the book, right?
During the process of writing the book, right.
Yeah, you wrote down all your experiences, and well, we'll get to that, right? But you wrote down all the experiences before you started doing the research. Really smart stuff, advice from your son there. Why don't we just start with your background, because it's your background also that makes this story of yours so unusual, so significant. Kind of reminds me a little bit of Dr. Brian Weiss when he first came out with Many Lives, Many Masters. Right. Tell us about that background.
Well, I grew up in a scientific family. My father was an academic neurosurgeon, and he instilled a very strong sense of science as the path to truth. Majored in chemistry, then went to Duke Medical School, and did my neurosurgical training at Duke and at Harvard. And then I spent about 15 years on faculty at Harvard Medical School at the Brigham Women's and the Children's Hospitals. And thought I had a very good idea about how the brain and mind and consciousness all worked. And, it was against that background that I then had my NDE. It changed everything that I thought about that relationship.
Well, yeah, which is really cool because, what I love about this, can I call you Eben?
Eben.
What I love about this, Eben, is that, first of all, you were the kind of skeptic that didn't really think too much about it at all, right? I mean, just that.
Oh, sorry about that. It's somehow queuing up again. That's too bad. It stopped and it should start again. That usually doesn't happen. I'm not sure why that happens. I'm trying to pick up the threads of that again, but somehow or other it just stopped. I'm not sure if the signal got weak or something. That's not what I'm looking for. Okay, we have it again.
Any descriptive words in our earthly realm fall woefully short of describing the power and awe of that being. And of course, that realization also showed me why our science, our our current level of science and even the potential for any of our scientific understanding in the material physicalist world will never, ever be able to weigh in pro or con to the existence of that deity, because that deity is so far beyond our wildest imagination and dreams as human beings stuck in human brain and body. And what I found was that when I entered that core, I was with this brilliant orb of light, brighter than a million suns, and that infinite darkness, but the infinite blackness contained every bit of that overpowering love, unconditional love. And it was totally outside of this universe. And when I say me, believe me, this was consciousness of all eternity and of all consciousness throughout the multiverse. This is not Eben Alexander's little conscious mind wandering on this journey, but it was all of us. And this is something that I think resonates with people with souls, because our souls do remember this. They know this deeply. And I'm just reminding souls of something they already know, trying to uncover that knowing that's within each and every one of us by being conscious. And that's another blessing from my journey, is you don't have to almost die to get this. In fact, just by being conscious, using centering prayer, deep meditation, these are ways that each and every one of us can get in touch with that absolute connection of that divine within each one of us that is there to give us that knowing of love and of our connectedness to each other and to all that exists, by quieting that little voice of kind of fear and anxiety in our head, and going deep into our own consciousness, and we can all get in touch with exactly what I encountered in the core.
Wow. That's amazing. All right. So many things that you talked about there. I'll back up a little bit. All right, let's just go to the butterfly, because, I saw you on TV a couple times. You talked about floating on the butterfly wing, and I thought, oh, the skeptics are going to love that, because it sounds very woo-woo. And what I'm wondering, though, is because I've recognized that, when people have near-death experiences, or my understanding is when we go to the spirit world, we're able to have whatever experience we want up there. Okay, whatever we can imagine, we can have. I'm wondering, was this idea of floating on the butterfly wing something that maybe, again, I know there was no sense of you as as Eben Alexander, but do you think it was more related, like it's just your experience, or are people to take it very literally, that there are butterflies floating around there, and the way we travel around is on the wing of them?
That's an excellent question. I mean, I would point out here that I now see near-death experiences and afterlife reports going back 2,500 years, to the Egyptian Book of the Dead, Plato. I see the similarities far more than I focus on the differences, because I see an underlying reality of an afterlife realm that's very real. It's more real and more fundamental than this earth-like reality that we live in. And I think that's very, very important. It's also important to realize I now see consciousness. I know from my experience, it proved to me that our spirit, our soul, is eternal. That consciousness, we are conscious in spite of our brain. And that's a very important concept. The brain is more of a reducing valve, a filter or a veil. And it's there for a purpose, that we are not always privy to that spiritual realm. Part of the problem, of course, is we would be inundated, because our higher soul, not limited down here on this side of the veil in the brain and body and in our little kind of earth-like existence, that higher soul is not stuck in space and time at all, and is actually aware of a much richer reality that extends through all eternity. And we really need to dumb that down to a trickle to have the stuff that's necessary for surviving in the here and now as a mammal, kind of going along with Darwinian selection on this earth. I mean, we can't know all of that when we're down here in the down and dirty physical realm. But there are ways that we can get back to it, get in touch with it, to peer behind that veil. And again, that has to do with deep meditation and with centering prayer. I would say also what I call the gift of desperation, which is often the way I saw this happen in my patients with terminal illnesses or family members. It's at that moment when your sense of loss is so great that you don't feel you could possibly handle any more, that often people would describe feeling that infinite love of God for them, and to know that they were loved and cherished and would be protected, and that it was all okay after all. And it's getting in touch with that, and again, through deep meditation. I have to do that first and foremost by getting rid of that little voice in my head, you know, that little voice of self, ego, that is, that's not the decision maker, mm-hmm. and I am. You know, I actually witness. That's how I know that the real I, which is the real us, which is all connected to the one at the core, needs to put that little voice in time out, because that voice of fear and anxiety, the self ego, you know, that is not the real me at all, and it needs to be turned off for me to get in touch with the much deeper aspects of our connectedness and oneness and that divine link to God.
Yeah. So I'll just back up a little bit on that. So would you say, are we talking more, it's more of a metaphor, the butterfly experience, or literal?
As I say, just the facts, ma'am. I mean, this,
yeah.
I just wrote the story as I remembered it. I wasn't editing it. I wasn't trying to write it for anybody, to please anybody. I wasn't thinking about, you know, literary metaphors. This is what I remembered. And, of course, you're right. There are the skeptics out there. Oh, this is ridiculous. Butterfly wing, beautiful girl, yeah. Well, guess what? It's what I remember. I didn't add things. It was actually a richer story than I portray in the book, because we did edit some of that original core story out, parts of it that are very illuminating about overall journey. Those are pieces that I often discuss in my presentations, so you can often hear that in presentations, and of course a lot of that will also be featured in my second book, kind of a real fleshing out of the lessons that I learned in the core. And what it all means. I mean, I go into, in the book, the whole notion of love, of that unconditional and infinite love of the Creator for each and every one of us, how that is the actual fabric of makeup of the higher dimensional aspects of this realm, and that evil is here as a trace impurity. It's all about our manifesting the love of that Creator, showing compassion and love for our fellow souls, even when we're down here in this kind of dumbed-down earthly realm. You know, that is the reason for our existence, is to manifest that love even in this imperfect world. And, you know, so none of this is metaphorical. I will say,
yeah.
I was reassured when I started reading some of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's works and found that when she had toured some of the concentration camps, and right after the end of World War II, she was stricken with the fact that often children who were being led into gas chambers were carving butterflies in the wood. And she puzzled over this for decades, and then finally came to see how butterflies were very often seen in that afterlife realm. And also stories of the Japan tornado and how the children reported butterfly angels that saved them, and some amazing stories. But it's not a metaphor. This is what I remembered, and I'm just reporting it.
Yeah, and I love that, because you could have, I'm sure you foresaw, you know, what some people would think of that, and you could have opted to not tell that part of the story, but we can see how important it was that you did.
To me, it was not my place to be editing strongly, because I thought something would be unpopular. And likewise, I wasn't going to add things in that weren't there.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people say, in the fundamentalist Christian realm, would prefer that I had seen Jesus. Well, I'm sorry, I didn't see Jesus, so I didn't put him in there, but I did see a loving God that was every bit the one that that Jesus knew and talked about, and that infinitely loving God is exactly who we saw and came to know very deeply. And also came to realize that we all know that God very deeply, and we can get in touch with that deep in our own consciousness.
You know, you talked a little bit about the evil. One of the things I thought was important that you mentioned in the book was that evil made free will possible. I mean, you touched upon that just a moment ago, but I loved the idea that the evil on our planet, for instance, in our physical existence, is what makes our human free will possible. Anything to expand on that?
Really, just that I must say, when I came back from this and realized and had felt the power of that omnipotent and all-loving God, it was hard to reconcile that with some of the evil and injustice that is allowed in our world. Especially, I wrestled with the suffering of innocent in our world, of children, right, animals. And it was, I really had to struggle and learn a lot, you know, knowing what I knew from my near-death experience and going into meditation a lot to keep uncovering some of the beautiful lessons there, to come to some kind of reconciliation about that. But it had to do very much with knowing that the love, that unconditional love, is so far beyond our imagination. I mean, that God loves each and every one of us far more than we love ourselves. And it explains so much about why belief was so encouraged by Jesus and by other teachers, because belief is what sets us free. To open ourselves to believe the possibility of it, then we can just go into our own consciousness and start to feel the power of that belief and to know that it actually manifests as reality in our lives, and that is because it's very real. It's fundamentally real. But we're supposed to live in a realm on this side of the veil where we don't know. It's not as clear as, say, the moon rising in the sky every night. If the spiritual realm and the reality of God in heaven were as real as the moon rising every night, we would not be able to treat this existence appropriately for our progress in the higher realm. We would not have the proper respect for this. And so there has to be that element of faith and belief. And that's why science will never prove pro or con the existence of that realm. Also, that God is so far beyond our wildest dreams, imaginations as human beings, that to even think that we could come close to proving yes or no is hubris of the highest order.
Well, I know a lot of our audience right now is probably wondering, when we're talking about these things, any sense that there is such a thing as hell? And you might follow it up. You talked about the light and the darkness. I realize it's a different subject, but when you talk about the light and the darkness, what I've heard about other people say about near-death experiences is that the darkness, there was light within the darkness, that the darkness was a very friendly, you know, velvety, you know, multi-dimensional, multi-sensory experience. But I know that a lot of people are wondering, we're talking about the evil here in the physical world, any sense that there was any sense of hell, and is that related at all to what you said about there being darkness?
Well, in fact, in terms of the evil, in terms of the badness, for those who hand out mayhem and pain and agony to others, they end up reaping what they sow, because in the life review, when they leave this body and go through their life review, they end up living that pain and agony that they dished out in every single instance as the recipient. And it's much worse in that pure spiritual realm to feel the agony of that pain that they've caused others. So in that sense, you could say there is a hell. There's not, in my view, there is not the eternal damnation that is pictured in kind of classic, Christianity. And the reason for that is this God is so perfect and so loving and so all-powerful that there's no way that part of that creation will be an eternal damnation. This is all about our spirits, our souls ascending in that outer realm and getting closer and closer to that all-loving Godhood. And it has to do with our learning lessons in this life. And that's why I look at hardship, difficulty, challenges. And as a healer, I look at disease and illness as the opportunities for growth. And our souls are here to learn lessons. And we learn them through the difficulties in this life. By embracing those difficulties and seeing them as learning opportunities, realizing that by manifesting that love and compassion in this imperfect realm, that is how we progress in that higher spiritual realm. And given that the whole direction of that and the fabric of that higher realm is made of that love, and that evil is but an impurity that allows us to manifest our free will, given that the ascendance in that outer realm has everything to do with moving towards that unconditional love from the Creator to the creation, anyone who's handing out mayhem and pain in this world is going to have to make up for that wrongward direction, either in this life or in other lives. So it's, it all is kind of the way I have to put it together. It does involve reincarnation as a very necessary part of it.
Yeah, that's true. The way it's written up in the book, there's sort of an end to this experience where you leave the core, you move away from the core and go back to that sort of muddy existence. But it's different than the first time you experienced it. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was kind of shocking when I remembered all this and I was trying to make sense of it, because I would be in the core where I was told, "We will teach you many things, but you will be going back." And this was taught by this divine, dazzling darkness of love of that God beyond our wildest imagination, and this brilliant orb of light. And they were teaching many things, but I didn't know back where. And I would then end up without any kind of pathway or foreshadowing. I just would be back in the earthworm eye view. And it was very shocking the first time. I couldn't understand any of this, and I still had no language, and I was trying to put this together. But by remembering, and the first time it took a very long time, but by remembering that melody, the notes of the melody, they were crucial at bringing back that spinning white light, the beautiful filamentous light that came spinning up out of the muck and opened as a portal into this gorgeous gateway. On the butterfly wing, beautiful girl beside me. Every time I went back in there, and several times this happened, where I would fall into the earth when my view, and then I had to remember the notes of the melody, spin that up, and I'd be back on the butterfly wing in the gateway with the beautiful girl, always that same lovely face, comforting thoughts of pure, unconditional love that I would be taken care of and cherished, and then outside of this universe, outside of all of eternity, to be taught more lessons by the orb of light and by that beautiful, loving presence. And it did happen several times. We're always saying, you will be going back. You're not here to stay. And one day that was true, where that spinning, trying to remember the notes didn't bring that spinning melody. And in fact, I was headed back down to the earthly realm. I didn't know or remembered at the time. And it was then that I became aware of the power of prayer, because I sensed these arcs of beings, everyone kneeling, many cloaked, holding candles, and there was this murmuring coming up from them, and there were thousands of them going off into the darkness, some with candles, and that murmuring and that energy was billowing these beautiful, brilliant clouds that were kind of bubbling me up and bringing me back up to this realm. And when I was writing it all up a few weeks later, the word I used was that they were praying for me, because that's exactly what they were doing. That word was not in my mind at the time.
Yeah.
In a sense, it was very comforting, because when I had found that the melody no longer worked to take me into that beautiful realm, I was very sad. I mean, sad beyond description, that the gates of heaven were closed. And that is when I had this beautiful vision of those praying for me and how they were on earth. This was not from any earthly scene, but you know, that was the origin of that scene, of thousands of people kneeling and murmuring and the energy coming from it. And that's what I often tell healthcare workers and families of very sick patients in talking about this, is never, ever think that the soul of that loved one is not present, and that the prayers get in. And I don't try and tell people that I came back because of prayer. I mean, there was a lot of prayer in my case, but I've known many similar cases as a neurosurgeon where wonderful families, patients with terminal diseases, lots of prayer, and yet that patient did not come back to us physically. And it wasn't for any lack of prayer or belief. But the important thing is the prayers do get in. And I don't care if the patient has already been pronounced dead in our medical terms. Know that that soul is present and aware, and how you treat that and how you think about that is very important. And so prayer does have tremendous power, and it's very comforting to that soul that is being prayed for.
That's really important to hear. A great reminder. Is there a wrong way to pray? Is there a right way to pray?
Just by believing and by knowing that there's a divine plan, you know, thy will not mine be done. Mm-hmm. For those 8 years before my coma, I'd given up on God, given up on prayer. I was praying for the wrong things, and I was trying to pray for things that, you know, that my ego and self might want, and those prayers went unanswered. And just know there's a divine plan. And just have faith that that love will carry us through whatever we face in this realm.
I also like the idea, you know, when you were going back to the earthworm view after leaving the core, and then you thought about the spinning melody again, and it brought you back up. I thought, what a wonderful metaphor. I understand that's a real experience, but it was wonderful metaphor for our physical life here. When we're feeling down, when things are down, when things are bad, to think of light, to have faith, those types of things. I wonder if it works the same way. You get the sense that it does? It lifts us up?
Very much. And my youngest sister, Phyllis, often tells me that when I first was waking up on that seventh morning and the doctors were shocked, you know, he can't be coming back, and ended up pulling the breathing tube out. I'd been on a ventilator all week. And she came up within, you know, minutes of my coming out of all this. And she said, I looked like a little Buddha sitting there on the bed, and I would look around at each one of the people, you know, doctors, nurses, family, totally shocked that I was back. And I'd look at each one of them kind of acknowledging the divine miracle that we're here. And each breath is a miracle. And I would say, all is well.
Wow.
Worry.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Well. And we are loved, cherished, and cared for. And by believing it and then feeling it deep in our own consciousness, feeling that divine connection, quieting that voice, the voice of fear and anxiety, the little voice in our head that's just a spectator, and getting in touch with that divine connection that we all share. And that's why it's all about loving each other, because by loving each other, we're loving ourselves and acknowledging that divine link that we all share at the deepest level.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Let's talk a little bit. So the woman that you met, the girl that you met, on the butterfly wing, more of like an angel or guide to you, the first being that you saw, I think, one, again, very compelling evidence that your experience was real and not imagined, is her identity. Do you mind sharing with us that?
I want to put out a spoiler alert.
Okay.
Because my preference is people read my book and feel what I felt. And that's what I try to present in the book, the way it's all laid out. So for those of you who really want to get the power of it and haven't read the book, spoiler alert right now. It turns out that I was adopted. I was put up for adoption when I was 2 weeks old, adopted age 4 months. And for a lot of my life, I looked for my birth mother through the North Carolina Children's Home. North Carolina had pretty strict laws. Never found that there was any interest on her part in finding me. And I adjusted to that. That's fine. I mean, she was going on with her life, and they left me to go on with my life, and I was okay with that. And then my son was doing a research project in school, sixth grade, in the year 2000, when he wanted to find out more about our family heritage. And he wouldn't let it go when I told him about my adoptive family heritage. He wanted to know about our biological family. So I thought I'd humor him. I wrote a letter to the North Carolina Children's Home, and I actually got a response back. Well, yes, we did find something out, and I detail all that in my book. It was a shocking 2 minutes in my life back in February 2000. Finding out that, in fact, my birth parents got married, which was a big shock based on all the information I had, that they had three children, that my youngest sister had passed over in 1998, and that they were still grieving, and it was not a good time to come back in their lives. And that sent me in a tailspin. That was, in fact, why I lost all faith in a loving, personal God, lost all faith in prayer in 2000. And that was lost for 8 years until my coma. And now, of course, that's all been healed forever. I will never, ever doubt the eternity of our souls and that all-loving God. But it turns out that as I was trying to understand the depth of my experience, and it was clearly a very powerful transcendental experience, and yet as I read more and more about near-death experiences, I was mystified. Why wasn't my father there? My adoptive father had passed over 4 years before my coma. And if I had scripted this, he would have been there front and center, but he was nowhere to be seen. And who was this mysterious girl? I could remember her face so perfectly. I knew I'd never met her in my whole life. So why was she there? And how come my dad wasn't there? And this was a deal breaker. I mean, I knew I'd had a profound spiritual experience when my brain should have supported no experience at all. So how come? Why? Such a deep mystery to it. And it was 4 months out from coma when I actually was able to put it all together. My birth sister, Kathy, had promised to send me a picture of Betsy, the sister who had passed on in 1998. And she did send that picture, and that was a very powerful emotional experience. She just looked so familiar, and it was the next morning when I was reading a story in Elizabeth Kubler-Ross about a girl who had a profound near-death experience, was in coma, and encountered her brother, and he gave her such beautiful, unconditional love of that realm, and they had the most adoring time together, and she was so blessed with it, but then he helped her make a decision to go back to Earth. And she did, and when she came back, she was mystified and talking with her father. I don't understand. I don't have a brother. And her father said, well, you did. He died 3 months before you were born, and we never told you about him. And I looked up at that picture that my birth sister had just sent me of my departed birth sister, Betsy, and I knew exactly who had been on the butterfly wing. It was the most powerful experience I've ever had in this life. I was absolutely certain of the identity, and yet, since I didn't really know her personality so well, I was just shocked at the power of this. But I said, "It can't be. I mean, that's too amazing." And so then I started calling my birth family every week or so. I would call and ask them questions, trying to get to know Betsy better. And as they told me more and more about how she had been this all-loving soul who would bring in stray cats and dogs and give them a home and feed them. And she worked in a rape crisis center and just took care of people that needed caring. And she was such a loving soul, often described as an angel. And it just became absolutely clear to me, of course, that's who it was. And the visual memory was perfect, and it's because that's who it was.
Wow. Okay, there's chills right there. So, you know, and the reason I brought it up, you know, I know it's a spoiler alert, but I know that a lot of the news stations have asked you in their 5-minute interviews that are all edited up. And I had two people come to me and say, could you ask them, you know, because they hadn't read the book yet, can you ask them because I'm so confused by that? And, you know, so anyways, this is nice because you had the time to be able to really explain it in depth. What a beautiful story. What a beautiful ending to the book. Really beautiful ending to this, you know, to this interview that we have here. All I can say is I hope people will go out and buy the book. I know they will. Everybody else in the country, if not the world, is doing it. Even with knowing that, I mean, I kind of suspected all the way through. Anyways, but even without knowing that, it's a page turner. You never know what's going to happen. It's amazing all the way through. As we end, as we close down here, and I wish it didn't have to happen because I wish I could talk to you for another few hours. You touched upon our reasons for existence here. I know that's probably a book in itself. Can we just end with maybe you just giving us a little sense of what we're doing here?
Yeah, it's such a beautiful message, and in many ways it's so simple. And what my experience very plainly demonstrates is that our consciousness, our spirit, our soul is eternal. We are spiritual beings. It is not dependent on the brain. And we are so much more than our physical bodies. And our true reason for being here as a spirit and soul extends far beyond the simple materialistic view that it just goes birth to death and that's all there is. We are so much more than that. And our relationships with our fellow souls are far richer than that, as is the meaning and the purpose for our being here at all.
Okay, powerful. Absorb that minute. Let me just show the title while everybody's absorbing that. Show the cover of the book again. You'll know it. It's on the back there. Proof of Heaven, Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife. There'll be a link below this video where people can get it on Amazon, can order it on Amazon. You've been a delight. You're a delight in so many ways. What a great guest, and you can feel your warmth and the love that you have in telling this story, and I'm really grateful for you joining us today. Evan, I thank you.
Thank you, and I also wanted to ask people to visit Eternia, Eternea.org, which is a site that we've started to educate people about all manner of spiritually transformed just near-death experiences, but and people can report their own experiences there, plus educational to help people understand consciousness, physics of consciousness, and how our spiritual existence is primary and science and spirituality can come together. That's a huge part of my message and my mission.
What is that website again?
Eternea.org, Eternea.org.
And okay. And your personal website is what?
Is lifebeyonddeath.net.
Okay. All right. Those links will be below the video as well.
Okay. That brings us to the end of that part. Interesting enough story. And I used to attend a monthly meeting on near-death experiences, so I've heard quite a few of the similar type of experiences. There may be a meeting of near-death experience in this town, Santa Cruz, I'm not sure. But wherever you live, wherever you might be picking up this this broadcast, you could check out your city or town, see if they have those kind of meetings there. And they can be quite interesting. All right, we're going to now go back and hear some more music. And as I say, Michael Crawford is our guest this evening on this show, and on this recording, it's called On Eagle's Wings, so we'll have that now.
shelter of the Lord, who abide in his shadow for life. Say to the Lord, my refuge, my rock, in whom I trust, and he will raise you up on eagle's wings, bear you on the breath of dawn, make you to shine like the sun, and hold you in the palm of his hand. You need not fear the terror of the night, nor the arrow that flies by day. Under his wings, your refuge, his faithfulness, your shield. For to his angels he's given a command to guard you in all of your ways. Upon their hands they will bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone. And he will raise you up on eagle's wings, bear you on the breath of dawn, make you to shine like the sun, and hold you in the palm of his hand.
Okay, that was Michael Crawford on Eagle's Wings. now, I'm going to go back now to Master Muji, and his name of this talk is Being Beyond Health. So,
What you've already said seems to a certain extent answer the question that I have, but there's so much charge around it that I feel that I still need to talk about it.
Yes.
For years, I've experienced a tremendous amount of anxiety, and it seems to really kind of coalesce around this idea that I must protect this body,
yes,
which then manifests in the continuous quest for perfect health.
Yes.
And yeah, there's just this very strong feeling I've got to be so careful about what I eat. I've got to take such good care of myself. I must absolutely preserve my health.
Yes.
And I can see under that there's still this belief that I am this body, and in order to preserve awareness and consciousness, I need this body as the vehicle for this to happen. And I almost feel like somehow I'm stuck here, that I want this anxiety to go away, and at the same time I'm the observer of wanting the anxiety to go away and the observer of the anxiety, But there's still so much fear, I guess, around the health of the body and food and how to take care of it. And I guess you said, what do you fear about letting go? And I fear letting go that somehow the body is just going to fall apart.
Yes, it will someday.
Yeah.
Even with the best care, mm-hmm. It's a burning candle, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say you should not take care of your body if this is what feels natural. But if there is some fear behind it,
mm-hmm. It's all motivated by fear.
And who is the one who feels, I must really preserve this body? You see?
Mm-hmm.
Have you?
It's the body wants to preserve.
I don't feel this is true, that it's the body that wants it. The body is not the sentient center of experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make decisions in that way. The thought is arising from wherever it's been picked up that I must take care of this body at any cost. Because without the body, I cannot exist. Therefore, when this body goes, if it goes, then finito. Curtains down. So it leaves, it may give you good health in this body, but always there's some anxiety, must be there. Because there is behind, you see that other bodies perish, they suffer. So there's an anxiety, I cannot let this happen here. So you cannot really be enjoying your existence even. I don't feel we are really enjoying it. You feel somehow, if you identify very strongly with the bodily existence, there's already a subtle traumatic state, because we feel, it's not eternal, this body. Whatever constructs the body, that is a different story, because you cannot destroy the elements. They're recycled somehow. But in this construction, you cannot keep it. So while it is here, find the thing that cannot decay. Find the thing which is even beyond health. Find that which is beyond health. And see which is the permanent, you see. Then make your stand with the permanent. Something witnesses this body. And at a certain age, you start to see little things are happening. You're still younger than me, so... you start to see things, okay, all right. And can you feel these changes and not be afraid, you see? When you hold on, like I was pointing to that sense of I am, spontaneously the fear will go. You will find your home. You will find that aspect of yourself. This aspect, you may find, it is continuously changing.
In a way, the anxiety is kind of like something familiar. Like you'd said, the mind will welcome you with open arms. It's like the anxiety is something that is familiar, and it's something to almost to turn back to. Because I don't even have the words for this, but sometimes I see or perceive that there is only this, that
there's only this.
There's only
this. Yes, yes.
And a dropping into that almost.
Yes.
But then I think there's the turn back and turn away and the fear, and then I go back to, well, I must take care of the, I must take care of the body.
Yes, yes, yes. Something is taking care of the body. Something is taking care of the body in everybody. That it resides is taken care. Even look at the fly. It's living on poo. Okay? But if you go close and you look at him, you see him. Even he knows how to take care of the body. Something is taking care of the body, even in this one, even. So something is here taking care of the body. and is doing it automatically. You see? To some extent, but it's not devoted to the body. It's not devoted to the body.
What is it that makes the there's the question of the doer, what is taking care of the body? Is it just identification with the thoughts that are arising, and these thoughts say must take care of?
No, some intelligence is already a package deal. Once it comes in, is already everything is functioning together. Who's taking care of making sure you're hungry at the right time? Who is doing it? Who is taking care of the beating heart? Or the moving lungs? You? It's not you. If it was you, you could not sleep because you might just forget to breathe. So some power is taking care of it. You see? But this thought, I must take care of it, has grown to a mighty proportion.
Yes, because it seems like the body has not been healthy. And so then I'm questioning, well, what is taking care of it then? I've done, apparently, my best.
Yes, yes.
Or what I thought was my best, and yet there was still not.
You know something? Some health. Maybe you may enjoy better health when you forget about it.
That is something I have considered, but there's that.
Yes, this
fear
won't let go.
So,
Yes. Yes. This is what we were talking about. This one friend is here also, I'm sure. About this thing, you want to let go of something, but you can't afford to let go, because if you let go, catastrophe is waiting. So this is already something. We just did also, Nataraj just made one YouTube. He's here also, this friend, called Catch 22. YouTube, Catch 22. He said, I am afraid to let go of something. I want to let go. I can't afford to let go. Because if I let go, then maybe catastrophe will happen. Something bad will happen. On top of this, he say, this feeling is in my core.
Yes, there's this constant knot here.
Yes. So I was saying, what tremendous bad luck you have to have all these things. The worst things can happen. You need to let go. I must let go in order to let go to existence. But I can't let go. If I let go, something is going to drop. And then it's in the very core, the essence is me. Like this. It's all thought. All of it is thought. You are already that perfect awareness, which is imperishable. Imperishable.
Okay, that was Master Muji, and let's see. Try to bring up some music for you now. No, it's not responding somehow or other. Oh, I ask of you. Okay. We have Michael Crawford still as our guest singer. And this one piece is All I Ask of You.
I have to paint a picture. The year, 1984. The place, the Apollo Victoria Theatre in London. Upstairs, after the final preview of Starlight Express, outside the men's room. The players, Andrew Lloyd Webber, and yours truly. Action. Andrew is headed for the loo. And on his way, he spies me and says, Michael, we must do Phantom of the Opera together. Though not being as foolish as I look, I said, yes, Andrew, love to. And the next morning, I rushed out and bought the book. And after reading through it a couple of times, I quickly realized there were only two male roles of any consequence. One was the handsome young nobleman, Raoul, and the other, a rather grotesque, slightly older man, the Phantom. Well, of course, I assume he wants me to play Raoul. So the next day I go out and I get a copy of the Claude Rains film version as the Phantom. And as the handsome young nobleman, Nelson Eddy. So for the next 12 months, I study this video morning, noon, and night. I lived and breathed Nelson Eddy. At the end of 12 months, for all intents and purposes, I was Nelson Eddy. I look like Nelson Eddy, I talk like Nelson, I even walk like Nelson Eddy. Wait. Finally, after 12 months of this, Andrew calls me. So I said, "Don't be ridiculous, operator. Of course I pay for the call." So he said, "I want to see you tomorrow morning." So the next morning, I ran, well, I didn't run, I walked as fast as I could. So, and I walked into the theater, I struck a pose, and I said, "Well, Andrew, I think you've got your handsome young nobleman, Raoul." And he said, "Yes, we do. We hired him last week." I said, "What?" He said, "We want you to be the Phantom." I said, "What? The ugly old..." And so I was. For over 1,300 performances, I donned the mask and the cape. Playing the Phantom most certainly changed my life. I loved playing him, and I always will. However, I do have one or two regrets. I'm not a bitter man. But I did, after all, waste a year of my life. And I thought that possibly this evening would give me an opportunity to maybe show you some of the work that I put in during my Nelson Eddy period. So maybe, with your permission, I could show you my Raoul. Right. Well, excuse me. I'll rephrase that. Maybe I could show you my interpretation of Raoul. Yes. And that... He'll explain it to you later, man. And that will... that will give me the chance to sing the beautiful duet, "All I Ask of You," with the beautiful Dale Christian. Please. You haven't heard it yet. All I ask of you, my friends, is that you appreciate all the work that went into this, and to remember that I do control all the chandeliers above your head. Forget these wide-eyed fears. I'm here, nothing can harm you. My words will warm and calm you. Let me be your freedom. Let daylight dry your tears. I'm here with you, beside you, to guard you and to guide you. Talk of summertime. Say you need me with you now and always. Promise me that all you say is true. That's all I ask of you. Let me be your shelter. Let me be your light. You're safe, no one will find you. Your fears are far behind you.
All I want is freedom, a world with no more love.
beside me, to hold me and to hide me.
Then say you'll share with me one love, one lifetime. Let me lead you from your solitude. Say you need me with you here beside you. Anywhere you go, let me go too. Love me, that's all I ask of you. That's all I ask of you.
Okay, we've come to the last piece of the evening, and this is a piece by Eckhart Tolle. It's called I Need Say Nothing. Let's see what that's about. I haven't heard it before myself.
I'm only pointing to that state. The silence. There's a vast power in that silence. That's why somebody said silence is the language God speaks. Everything else is a bad translation. So it is something infinitely precious, and it's far more than silence. We are just using that word. There's an infinite power within and without, and it has a gentleness to it and yet incredible power to it, and it is love itself. It sounds strange, but that's how it is. It's always there. When it's not there, it means you've cut yourself off from it. And inner and outer merge in that. Even the entire energy field of your body is silent, but alive. And there comes the human mind. And even when once you dwell in silence, the inner silence I call stillness. Once it's very helpful to use outer silence as a teacher, especially in nature. And then after a while, you don't even need that anymore, because wherever you go, you have the inner silence is there. And even in the middle of a city, noisy city street, there's a stillness inside. And we are not dependent on outer silence, which now it's back. But whether that machine is going or not, it doesn't affect the inner. But until you become deeply established in the inner stillness, or the inner stillness has emerged more fully, it's very helpful to use silence as your teacher, the outer silence. I mean, you don't need any other if that were the only teacher you have, it would be quite enough. If you never read another book on spiritual things, or never saw another, never went to another workshop or another talk, and all you did was to remember to listen to silence whenever possible, that's all you need. Through that, the new consciousness, the stillness would emerge more and more in response. And then there's a meeting of inner and outer silence, a oneness. At this moment, silence is teaching. You may find you drift out of silence and then move back into it, out of it, mind comes in and then you move back into it. That's fine. I mentioned last night the most profound statement in the Bible, be still and know that I am God.
Okay, so I think we get the gist of that. There is some more to that talk, but because it's mostly silence, I think we'll leave that. I was a bit afraid I didn't give any technique out for you to on tonight's show, but this is a technique of going into the silence. So that'll be your technique for the rest of the week, to practice going into the silence, practice learning from the silence. The silence can teach you. So that'll be good. That'll be a good little learning technique for you. I didn't set up a guided meditation for you. I'm actually convalescing from a recent hospital admission, and so I basically got out of my convalescent bed to come here and put this show on. So I didn't have everything prepared as I should have. So all right, now we're basically at the end of the show. And I'd like to thank you for being with me during this show, 2-hour show on Monday. And I'll be back tomorrow at 7 to 8. From 7 to 8, if you're free, come and join me. We're going to go out now with Sarah Brightman's, I believe, When You Wish Upon a Star. No, that's not the one I'm looking for. All right, so I found what I was looking for. Sarah Brightman, Wish You Were Somewhere Here Again. Okay. From Phantom of the Opera. Yeah.
contribution of coming from local labor unions, two dozen labor unions in the area that all contributed. Anywhere from 50 bucks to several hundred dollars to support the protest. And we also get support from